There is trouble in paradise. The government parties have fallen out with each other.
Now, we're only a year and a half in government.
In
terms of this arrangement.
There's constant charge against me. Spin because he has no case against us when it comes to subs.
5-9.
My charge against him is he's obsessed with innuendo and conspiracy theories.
It's not good enough to just pass the buck. There is something rotten in the state of Denmark, and ultimately somebody has to bear responsibility.
Yeah, we're in the Houses of Parliament on national television.
Hello, it's Áine Lawler with the Your Politics podcast again, and with me, Mary Regan, Paul Cunningham and Micheál Lehan from our political staff. And while it's been a quiet enough week here in Dublin on the political front, look at London. What a week it's been.
The court is bound to conclude, therefore, that the decision to advise Her Majesty to prorogue Parliament was unlawful.
Mr. Speaker, the truth is that members opposite are living in a fantasy world. They really imagine that somehow they are going to cancel. This is what they want to do. They're going to cancel the first referendum. They're going to legislate for a second referendum.
There was an atmosphere in the chamber worse than any I've known in my 22 years in the House.
Peter Foster, as we speak this Thursday, Parliament is discussing a really, really bitter and angry night in the House of Commons after its resumption, after that Supreme Court judgment. Speaker Bercow saying it was the most toxic night in his parliamentary career. Now, what was your take?
Well, I think the politest thing you could say is it was combative. I think, you know, the darkest thing you can say is that British politics is moving into a space that, we're familiar with, I think, from the United States. I mean, you'll remember Donald Trump, mocking John McCain, the war hero, I like my heroes not to get captured, knocking that disabled New York Times reporter, and this fermenting, frothing outrage. But, of course, he won the presidency. He did it in the polls. And Boris Johnson, coming back from New York early, allegedly chastened by the Supreme Court judgment, but in fact pretty much unapologetic, and using his platform in the Commons to absolutely, as you say, stoke outrage among Labour MPs, repeatedly referring to the Benn Act, which requires him to seek an extension if he can't get a deal by the European Council, as the Surrender Act, and when confronted by a Labour MP and asked to moderate his language, referring to the murder of Joe Cox in 2016, Mr. Johnson described it as humbug. And I think, there has been real outrage on the Labour benches, and Diane Abbott, the Shadow Home Secretary, saying today that any hope that you might have harboured of Labour votes being used to put over a Boris Johnson Brexit deal now seem to have expired.
And of course, Boris Johnson is only aching for an election. His message last night and his language may infuriate politicians, but going full Trump, that may pay off, mightn't it, in a general election that many believe is inevitable, whether it happens before the end of October or not.
I mean, that's the million-dollar, million-euro, million-pound question. Is the British electorate able to be divided and ruled in this way? It seems pretty clear to me, and it has been, I think, for a while, that the strategy here is to get to the election, is to get to the barricades with the forces of Brexit aligned and united in fury against the Remainers, against Parliament, against the judiciary, and pretty much everything that Boris Johnson has done appears to point in that direction. You remember his first statement to the House on July 25th, ruled out time limits, ruled out exit mechanisms, demanded the abolition of the backstop, the ruthless sacking of 21 Remainer MPs, including the grandson of his own hero, Sir Winston Churchill. All of that points to the decision to prorogue Parliament. On and on it goes, this very hard line which seems to be designed to sort of drive a wedge between the country and, as I say, align the forces of Brexit against the forces of Remain.
So we're left with a government that can't government, a Parliament that only knows what it does not want, and the EU saying it can't see any operable legal proposals coming from the UK side, despite having seen four non-papers so far. So what breaks the stalemate here?
Well, I think, you know, the EU is just really stuck watching and waiting. It doesn't see, as you say, any kind of stable majority. So, you know, a general election perhaps breaks the stalemate. I think the EU is pretty much resigned to a very combative Boris Johnson coming to the European Council on the 17th, 18th of October. I don't hear any optimism, as you say, on the EU side, both about the mechanics of a deal, about the legal and technical mechanics of getting an operable alternative to the Irish backstop, or the politics of a deal. And so everybody hopes that a general election will create a new political reality where there will be some clarity and there will be solutions. Of course, we don't know what the result was going to be. It could well be a hung parliament, in which case we go back round in circles. Mm-hmm. It could be a big Boris Johnson majority, in which case the United Kingdom is headed for a very hard Brexit, potentially with Northern Ireland left in a special relationship with the EU, and that will have implications for the British Union. But it seems difficult to think that there is another way out. There is one other possibility which is being discussed, which is that there would potentially be a majority in Parliament for something like Theresa May's deal, perhaps with some added sweeteners to encourage the Labour side to join, subject to a second referendum. Is it possible to find a way for the Remain stroke moderate forces in Parliament to unite behind May's deal with some sweeteners and subject to a second confirmatory referendum? And if they could demonstrate there was a solid majority in Parliament for that, then maybe, just maybe, you could see a world in which the Boris Johnson, the very hard Brexit forces could be outflanked. But that essentially means the Parliament taking over from the executive, and that would be completely unprecedented. And I think, you know, there are many, many hoops to jump through before those kind of ideas, which you do hear kicking around Westminster, come to fruition.
And looking at Parliament having won its time back with the Supreme Court judgment, it doesn't seem to know very much what to do with it.
No, isn't that an irony? You know, there's been no legislation table for months and months now. The government's terrified that any legislation will become a hook for amendments that will frustrate its attempts to move towards a no-deal Brexit or a hard Brexit. And so, really, you know, Parliament has just become an echo chamber for rage. Lots of urgent questions, trying to pick holes in Boris Johnson and in potential scandals about his love life and about whether he did or didn't improperly use public funds to reward a colleague and contact. You know, you're going to see more and more of that, more and more venting. But whether or not Parliament, as I say, can come together in some meaningful way to take control of business and actually outflank the government, that I think is the question.
Well, we won't answer it yet, but let's hope we do get an answer before the 31st. Peter Foster, thanks a million for talking to us. So Peter Foster there on the range of options and this hope that Parliament might somehow conjure up a majority for a deal. On the other hand, the ways that Boris can seems to be determined to fight this people's champion against the Parliament stance, Mary Regan. What's your take on what we've seen in London this week?
Well, I just thought it was quite extraordinary watching the scenes in the House of Commons. He was described there as being allegedly chastened but unapologetic. And I think when we saw him dismissing as humbug this very powerful appeal by the Labour Party MP Paula Sheriff to dial down the rhetoric and to remember the language of betrayal that he is using was part, as she saw it, as what underpinned the murder of Joe Cox. And then when you heard a number of other women MPs standing up and echoing those very emotional appeals, yet Boris Johnson seemed to sort of carry on regardless with this language. And, you know, I think they would see certainly as him not being very apologetic at all. In fact, you know, they could argue the case, and I suppose they have been doing so in the House of Commons, that he was carrying on doing exactly what they told him was a dangerous thing to do.
But, you know, we hear this Thursday afternoon, Paul, of, you know, rows in the House of Commons lobby. We've seen MPs stand up and talk about death threats to themselves, death threats to their children. I mean, this is these are some of the most remarkable scenes we've seen. The Supreme Court judgment, the Commons, but none of us gets us any closer to a solution.
And I don't believe that Boris Johnson sees any solution within this current parliament. So he's not speaking to MPs. He doesn't care about extending the hand of friendship, trying to secure some form of compromise within the parliament as it's currently constituted. As Peter was saying earlier, he's looking beyond. He's looking to the general election. He's looking to those people who voted to leave. And if you remember the European elections, Brexit Party didn't exist, got 29 seats and became the biggest party. He feels that there's a mandate there and he's going to swerve right rather than middle of the road and certainly not to the left. And the only question is, how does he get there? Mm-hmm. Does he collapse and fall over the line? And from Dublin, sitting looking at that behaviour, mm-hmm. looking at how things are unfolding, one can only be pessimistic. I mean, even coming from Brussels, you're beginning to hear EU officials in private or without being named talking about how they believe this facade of seeking a deal just is that, a facade and nothing more behind it. So it's deeply worrying about the trajectory we're on, and the language is just one aspect of how it all is looking more negative than positive.
And we heard as well from the Taoiseach this week, and indeed from the Taoiseach in the United States, talking about, you know, the pressure that there's been, this campaign almost, to, you know, get the Irish to back down on the backstop, and Ireland saying, we can't, we won't, we need legally operable solutions on the border.
And that's a consistent message which has been applied across the board in, you know, when Leo Varadkar was meeting other EU leaders in New York, he was saying the same thing. We know that the Irish diplomats are, you know, fanning out across Europe, repeating the same message. But we also look to what the UK is doing, and they have MPs going to other European countries talking about how Ireland is can't be relied on. It is the UK which is NATO. It's the UK which is doing all these things. So there is an absolute war out there. You mightn't be seeing it all the time, but it's there. It's hand-to-hand combat.
A diplomatic war of words. So what does all of this end up looking like? Micheál, Mary, Paul, any of you, extension and election at this stage?
Yeah, I suppose it looks more like an extension, but how you actually get to that point is less clear. And from Boris Johnson's point of view, it's clear what kind of message he would have in the election. It's the people versus the parliament. But even that, which looked like a very clear, thought-out strategy, could you say that his judgment so far, especially in how he handled last night's debate, that there are major questions about that, that he has strayed wrong already and that there are missteps? And could there be just a real lack of knowledge about how to proceed? Could there be a real fear about how to proceed despite the bluster and despite everything?
Could it be as big a mess as it looks and nobody
exactly.
has a plan?
Exactly.
And meanwhile, we here in this Thal, we watch, we wait. It's almost like we're powerless.
Well, that is reflected in the expectation of the budget, which is nearly upon us. We're being told, don't expect much. You know, big taxes, no, that's gone. No big innovations. We're looking at leaks, there are none. We're being told the carbon tax, yes, that will happen. There will be some measures to try and assist people in poverty, the weakest in society, and the rest of it, forget about it. There isn't anything happening. And you can see the life sucked out of Leinster House. The debates are taking place, but there doesn't seem to be much life to it because we are held hostage by Brexit. We wait to see what's going to happen. Only on the basis of the outcome of that will decisions be made.
And indeed, Pascal Donoghue's been pointing out, you know, they won't be able to give clarity on what will be happening about the border because they won't have concluded the talks with the EU Commission because they need to see what happens in terms of Brexit at the EU Council meeting. We're not in control of our own destiny.
No, and you feel nothing becomes clear until after that European summit, whether it's detail on the checks close to or far away from the border. And all the time, the energy drains out of here. And as well as that, without having really any evidence to flesh it out, TDs, perhaps because there's a lack of real work to be done here, have got it into their heads that there is a possibility of a November election as well and no by-elections taking place. All that is what's in the mix floating around here, but not a lot of real work being done at all.
And of course, the elections we do know that will be happening, those by-elections, you've got a blog coming out on that this weekend, Micheál. You've been looking at them.
Yeah, the lie of the land is interesting there, and it does. We can go back to by-elections and say that they're separate, they're removed, they're standalone, governments don't win them, all that kind of talk. You'll hear that. But what they can illustrate is momentum. Think of Michael Ring back in June 1994 with that famous slogan, give the Dáil a ring, that suddenly saw him go ahead of Beverly Flynn as she was then, and he was on the back foot and gets elected in June and Fine Gael are in government by December. You think that day when Cecilia Keaveney and Brian Lenihan got elected, the momentum that gave Fianna Fáil going into 97. So given the positioning of these particular by-elections, they could be significant in determining who gets the momentum. And if you just go through them briefly, you look at Wexford and you think, and the private polling that's taken place among the parties, I think, says the same thing. This looks like a shootout between Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael for that seat, between Verona Murphy and, we would expect, Malcolm Byrne, two well-known people. Hard to know which way that would go. Fianna Fáil perhaps might have the edge there. You look at Dublin Fingal. Again, this particular place has a green tradition. For that reason, could someone like Joe O'Brien come into the reckoning? Could Labour have a good run here with the young candidate, Duncan Smith, Lorraine Clifford Lee for Fianna Fáil, a prominent contender, James Riley back in the field for Fine Gael? But you think, and you look at the ground there and you say, well, that is open for a major independent to come in, perhaps with Claire Daly's blessing. That hasn't happened so far. So for those reasons, again, it looks like Fianna Fáil with a strong chance. But could the Greens, because of the Trevor Sargent tradition as well, come into the reckoning there? Then you look at Cork North Central. Seems straightforward at the outset that the Fianna Fáil candidate is the strongest. It's the Billy Kelleher seat that they're trying to defend there. Pádraig O'Sullivan is the candidate. But it's interesting that Pádraig O'Sullivan was selected last year to run in the neighbouring constituency of Cork East. That's something his opponents will point to. Also, Colin Burke, the ever hard working and former mayor of Cork, Colin Burke, will do well here, but perhaps not well enough. Labour, with John Maher and Kathleen Lynch pushing aside and letting the younger generation come through, probably won't contend. Interesting test for Sinn Féin here with Thomas Gould, given that this is where they have a seat with Jonathan O'Brien. Can they at least show that there are signs of recovery, that there's an improvement? Wexford too is interesting for Sinn Féin, because when you think of the candidate in Wexford, most likely Johnny Mython, he came within 52 votes of taking the final seat in 2016 from Paul Keogh, but in the last local elections just a few months ago, he lost his seat. So you have to see in this contest, are there signs of improvement compared to the recent series of elections? Then Dublin Midwest, less clear. Could someone like Paul Gogarty come back into the running? Eimear Higgins will be the Fine Gael candidate selected next week. She, strong runner to hold on to that Francis Fitzgerald seat, you think. Sinn Féin could do well here. It's on a Wren seat. Mark Ward, the likely candidate. But if there isn't an independent in Midwest, you would think that is the one that Fine Gael could hold. The Fine Gael message is, all we need to do is win one. That could be the one.
Micheál, I'm just in awe here, because anyone listening to this, you don't realise, but Micheál Lehane has just come out with all those facts, figures and names all off the top of his head, which is proof you really have been doing your homework. So I really do look forward to seeing that blog. This, of course, is the fallout of the European elections. What do you think, Mary and Paul, all of this means in terms of a general election, and whether Leo will get his general election next May, or whether it might, as the TDs on the doorsteps fear, be a lot sooner?
Well, I think it's going to be a very interesting testing of the temperature for all the party leaders. And, you know, we talk a lot about Brexit sucking the life out of politics here and all the focus being on Brexit. But most people around the country are getting on with their everyday lives and everyday issues that are affecting them. Big issues like we heard talking to Dáil this week about the ambulance services and the length of time people are waiting for ambulances, waiting lists, especially for children, and the various occupational therapy, speech therapy, and a lot of questions around the health service. And obviously the farmers as well, and the beef prices. So there's a lot of real issues that maybe the governing parties, and especially, you know, if you see the Taoiseach and other ministers and party leaders travelling around the country meeting people, might get a lot of feedback that might feed into their considerations and their hopes and fears for a coming general election.
I still don't believe that there will be a general election in 2019. I think it will roll into 2020. I think there's just too much uncertainty, and just even last night's exchanges in the House of Commons indicate how crazy things can get. I think launching into a general election campaign when Varadkar and co have been talking about stability and we're going to guide you through this, I think it would throw out one of the main things they have to offer the electorate, which is that you can rely on us. So my good feeling is, even if they think about it, even if they talk about it, they're not actually going to do it.
All right, but we're certainly in a very long election campaign then, likely for the winter ahead. Yeah. Thanks a million, everyone. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, subscribe and leave a review. Also, tune in to our colleagues on Brexit Republic, as ever, essential listening. Thanks to Jack Good on production, and we'll talk to you all again next week.